The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Review Book Club. I'm Claire Armistead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer. Our latest guest is Barbara Kingsolver, who came in to talk about her bestseller, The Poisonwood Bible. It's the story of an evangelical missionary from the southern states of America who takes his family to the Congo. It's told in the voices of his wife and four daughters. Kingsolver's own family had been on just such an adventure when she was seven. But host John Mullen asked her if she really could have remembered what it was like.
Well, the visceral things, it's interesting that you ask it that way, because the smells, the sort of gestalt of the place, yeah. The feel of the place, I do remember. What I didn't know at the time that I was, you know, a seven-year-old was everything else. You know, the politics, the difficulty just that my mother was going through every day to try to find food enough to put on our table, which there wasn't much. The fact that we were being potentially exposed to smallpox. I thought it was just a great adventure. And yes, I did notice the smells, you know. And so I think without that stint of having lived there as a child, I couldn't have written this book. But that was not enough. And that's really important to say, that I did a huge amount of research. I mean, years and years and years. A lot of it reading, a lot of library stuff, archives, trying to get secret CIA files from, you know, the Library of Congress. And I read about poisonous snakes. I read about ants. I read about tropical diseases. I read a lot of missionary, self-published missionary memoirs. Yeah. That were not very well written, but just very sweet somehow.
And so these are kind of nicer versions of Nathan.
Right, exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, like the declawed Nathans. And then, of course, I did go back to Africa. I took several trips into Central Africa and West Africa, but I was politically, legally not allowed to go back into the Congo. And I wasn't sure. I really didn't think I could write the book without going back. But as I wrote in that little essay, my husband called me out. He said, "You're using that as an excuse."
Yes.
Which, of course, he was right. This is what husbands are for, right? Really, what he said was, just start. Just start writing. See how far you get. And if you hit a wall, if you really have to go back, we'll find a way to get you back. And it turns out I didn't. It turned out that for those visceral memories, for the smells, my memories were enough.
Right. And the ants, for instance, that is an incredible... Everybody reads the novel, remembers the ants.
That was Oprah's favorite part.
Yeah, I bet it was Oprah's favorite part. The ants thing's real.
It's real.
Do get that.
It's real, and part of the point is that I have to begin by saying, even though I lived there, you know, for a time when I was 7 years old, my father is not, this is the standard, you know, the catechism, my father is not Nathan Price. He's a really nice person. I was not raised religious. He was a physician, and he and my mom were public health workers. They went to work as physicians in this really remote station. So a lot of these things, in some version or other, I did experience. And we did have a night of the ants when the ants came through. And it wasn't quite as dire as this. It was just kind of, they came through our house, which sort of had no glass in the windows. And there were people who lived near us who said, "Oh, well, when the ants come, you just move. Just leave. You know, just walk, like, no big deal. Leave the house, come back, and the great thing is it's clean." And they were right, and so real. And I guess as a kid, I was greatly entertained by this idea that you don't really have to clean up your room. If you wait long enough, the ants will do it for you. I've been telling my 16-year-old this. If you wait long enough, the ants will come. So just seeing how what seemed like a horror film to us, or could have seemed that way, was ordinary life for people who saw themselves as a part of their place. Biologically, yeah. The ants are part of their ecosystem.
Well, I was going to say, yeah. I mean, there are moments in the Poisonwood Bible when one can see that the person who's written this novel has had a biological training, an mm-hmm. academic training in biology, because there's actually a bit towards the end when Ada is talking, writing, speaking to us. She gives us kind of what you could call a rather Darwinian sort of spin on it, that all these things which we think are bad, and she takes the ants as one metaphor, mm-hmm. actually it's all part of some, what she, from her training, sees as a kind of very purposeful, even rather elegant kind of natural system.
It's a huge natural system, and it's going back to the beginning of human origins. The parasites have learned to live with the people just as the people have learned to live or not live with the parasites, and she kind of says, because she's Ada, and she represents that strange, rather detached, purely scientific point, a sort of amoral, non-judgmental point of view, she says, well, who can say whether you should really root for the humans or the parasites? They're both really clever. Mm. And she represents a point of view. This is another part of the catechism. I'm not Ada, and Ada's not me. I have some... It's a funny thing. Sometimes people will write to you saying, how could you say that about the parasites? Yeah. And it wasn't me. And the way I constructed this novel was to begin with a big question about kind of culpability, about what one country will do to another and how we live with that after it's been done. I mean, we didn't do this. I wasn't in that meeting where Eisenhower, you know, said, okay, kill the prime minister that they've just elected, steal this country's fledgling democracy so we can keep our hands in their cobalt mines. I don't think those were his exact words, but the transcription line that runs underneath that, you know, the screen, that's what it was. I wasn't there. I was hardly born yet. And yet, the prosperity that came to my country, and your country too, from these decisions, these sort of colonial relationships that shifted into post-colonial relationships that really were hardly better, except on paper. Look at the prosperity that has come to our nations because of this, and we live with that prosperity, and we live with that disparity between the countries that have the extractive industries and pull out the diamonds and the countries that have been extracted. We live with that. So how do we live with that? What is our responsibility? To remember, to forget, to carry on, to ignore it? And I, you know, that's the question that gave me the Poisonwood Bible. One carries this as a burden, like the loss of a child, that kind of a burden. And so that point of view is represented by Orleana. On the opposite end of the spectrum is a position of, what me worry? As long as my hair looks great, I'm happy. You know, stick out your elbows and let the other people carry you along. That's Rachel. And then in between, I had a sort of a spiritual path of to redemption, which was represented by Ruth May. And then a sort of political activist path to redemption, which was originally represented by Leah. And then in sort of midway through the first draft, I realized that was getting complicated. I was sort of, Leah was at war with herself because she kind of had two parts. She had the sort of more optimistic activist point of view that would sometimes fall over into this more detached scientific analysis, sort of more morally detached. And then it dawned on me, oh, I need two characters. So, bing, I split her into twins, just like that.
It's quite an unusual thing, I think, for a novelist to sort of say about how they designed a novel. Or writers have sat on this stage and said, oh, when I think of a character, and then they will say different things. But often they will say, it's the voice I hear. I hear them speaking. And then they come to me, and then all their other attitudes and things fall into place after that.
See, that's a disease state. They give you drugs for that, right? When you hear voices in your head. No, I'm kidding. I hear... not exactly kidding, because it's true. I mean, I do hear voices as well. I mean, there you reach a point where the characters are talking to you, you're hearing them. I kind of more see a movie. I'm watching the movie. I really watch the scene carefully, then I put it into language. But It's not like the Son of Sam or something. It doesn't just like zoom into my head. I generate the voices. I couldn't begin with character, and here's why. What character would be so cooperative? I mean, they had to be my slaves. They have to do exactly what I say, because we got stuff to do here.
Yeah.
This is not a lot of space. You know, you got to pack in all this plot. You got to get these questions answered. You have to make it all dazzling. And if I used people that I actually knew, they would just like say, I don't like the ants, you know. I mean, they wouldn't...
Yeah, cooperate.
Right. Yeah. So I have to invent them from whole cloth, so that they will be exactly the kind of people who will do what I need them to do. I blame it maybe on my training as a scientist, because that's my background. And I kind of set up a novel the way you'd set up an experiment. I have a null hypothesis.
Right.
The difference is I get to completely control the experimental conditions and the environment and everything, but that's really, you know, that's the best part. For me to invent character, it works best to begin with what they have to do and then work backwards to create the life history and the conditions that will make them the kind of people who will do what they have to do. Doesn't that make sense?
Yeah, you know,
I kind of think of myself as a therapist in reverse, because I create these people and then I work backwards and give them damage, right?
The character's got the most damage, who's Nathan. You decided kind of early on, he talks, but he's not going to have
Nathan. Yeah, he talks, but he doesn't talk to you.
No.
I set this up as an allegory. It's a political allegory, right? So his relationship with his wife and daughters is allegorical to the West's relationship with Africa. I wanted to bring the reader into this story, to ask the reader to look what we've done here. Look at the damage, you know, that has been wrought in our names. And I wanted the reader to really not run away, but get involved here. And so I thought, this is the story of the captive witnesses, because we're the captive witnesses. As I said earlier, we didn't make these choices. We are, however, every day in some sense coerced to participate in these choices, the history, the colonial histories of our countries. So we're the wife and daughters. We're not Nathan. That's why he has no voice. I wanted the reader to relate to the story of these girls and this woman and put themselves in that position and kind of analyze the circumstances, rather than just starting with, you know, this sort of self-flagellating, we did this, what to do. Just to think about the position of being the captive witness. In fact, one of the great challenges of fiction, I think, is loving all of your characters equally. As the novelist, I'm like the mom. I've got the good kids, I got the bad kids, I got the real stinkers, but I have to love them in the sense that I know they mean well. You know, just like if you had a kid in prison or something, you still love who they started out to be and what they could have been, and you want the best for them in the way that the best can be, and above all, I mean, this is where the novelist part comes in, above all, you get them. You understand that they think they're a good person.
Mm.
If I don't start out that way, the bad characters will be hollow for you. They'll ring false, because what person really doesn't think he's a good person? So I did have to love Nathan in his way, I mean, in my way.
There's this kind of very clever thing that actually the character, Leah, she's the one who understands the politics. So she's the one who understands all the stuff that you found out about, and you've given that understanding to her.
Right.
And she's the one, she's the idealist, and she
married to the revolutionary.
Yeah, and she marries the good guy, and she stays in the Congo. I mean, she goes back to America a few times, but she stays in the Congo. But then there's kind of, and you're thinking, you know, Nathan's gone, so he's no longer exerting his influence, as he does all the time tyrannically for the first half of the novel. But then she herself says things, you know, there's enough of my father in me that, you know, her righteousness is far more sympathetic than his.
Yeah.
But it is kind of his as well, isn't
it? She's the ideologue.
Yeah.
And it's not an accident that she... Of course, there are no accidents, right? It's a novel. She names her youngest child for her father.
Yeah.
Recognizing that idealism is always going to be a part of history, and that a lot of the good things that happened in the story were because of ideologue, came from ideologues, and that he was a very badly misguided ideologue. That's why his Bible turned out to be the Poisonwood Bible. But it could have been better than that. Mm. It just wasn't. But, I mean, these are all paths to redemption. So I felt that Leah's redemption involved, in part, ownership of where she came from and what allowed her to stay and do what she did. Mm. She just took what he taught her and kind of left out the the crazy parts.
Yeah.
And yet, her children are African.
Yes.
So she can't leave, and she promises the one time when they're taking Anatole away to prison, and what she said, the one thing, she has a chance to tell him one thing, and she says, your sons will always be African. That's the promise that she's made. So that's the difference. Mm. It's a huge crisis. I mean, she suffers such a crisis of faith. In the center, the center of her arc, the bottom of her arc is that night in the boat when they've run from the ants, and she's in the boat with Anatole, and she has tried so hard to believe in the righteousness of her father's plan, and she suddenly just, the bottom has dropped out of everything. She has nothing to believe in, not her father, not even Jesus. I mean, she says to Anatole, it's all wrong, isn't it? And he won't answer. He just says, you know, there's right for you, you know, we're different people. And so as she reconstructs herself, as a citizen of Africa, in a sense, because she sees her father's mistake, which is that he couldn't see what was in front of him. He couldn't see the righteousness, the beauty, the intelligence. That was his mistake, of course. I mean, that's the whole of his mistake. And once she sees his mistake, she understands she can be the same kind of person, but she can embrace rather than arrogantly reject. Mm.
The ending is Ruth May, really. And
she's narrating.
Yeah. So, the narration, you know, it's narrated by a dead person, a dead infant.
You could say that.
Yeah? Yeah, yeah, yeah. And is that a decision kind of made early on, or...
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, because the eyes in the trees are always there. I call it a spiritual path. It's not, you know, exactly religious, but she ends up becoming Muntu. She's the one who receives from when she's really, really sick, and Nelson, the boy who's helping them out in the house, thinks she's going to die, and so he comes and he gives her this little amulet. Mm-hmm. I actually, in my research, one of the trips I took was into Benin, and I was amazingly lucky to get to go to an Africa-wide voodoo festival and talk to people and talk to all of these religious people. And so I received these amulets, and I had this incredible conversation with a spiritual man who sort of sat me down like a doctor, and I actually had this conversation with him. He gave me this amulet, and he said, okay, this is so you'll never die. Okay, you know, you like it when a doctor says that, right? This is so you'll never die. This translates your Bantu into Muntu, the individual person into personhood, I guess, like the person-ness in you that never leaves. And he said, here's what you do. Think of a place where you want to end up, just a physical place, like, you know, like your garden or something. And for Ruth May, it was up in the tree that she loved to climb and spy from. So think of that place every day. So when when the moment comes, like your car, you know, like the head-on collision is about to happen, you will transfer to that place. Okay. And I was just amazed. Believe me, I've got that thing. Maybe later that night after that transaction had happened, or maybe the next day, I thought, this is the soul of this novel. Because if it's a novel about redemption and how we pull past history into the future, I have to use this spiritual concept of sort of taking our losses, everything, losses and gains, and recognizing that they all become a part of the humanity to which we belong. So I gave Ruth May that role of transforming from Bantu to Muntu. So in the end, she's the eyes in the trees. She's still there in her way, telling you, here we all are, all changed. Because they want to see the grave somehow, because this is so Western, we want to visit the grave. I guess they never really even saw her buried. They just took off. Yeah. They get as close as they can, and then they ask this woman, there's a village, we know, it's there. There was this guy, and this happened, and that happened. And then this woman says, mm-mm, that never happened. That place never existed. That's how I wanted to end it.
It's time for any of you to ask questions. You can ask Barbara where her place is.
I'm interested by the fact that you, Ada was, from what you say, almost an afterthought in the order of creation of characters.
Okay.
When, in fact, it seems to me there's quite a lot of similarities between her and you as an author. Her obsession with structure, with symmetry, palindromes.
The fact that I only have half a brain.
The second question was, why do you think that light relief is needed?
Ada is not an afterthought. Let me put this in perspective. I created Ada about two-thirds of the way through a first draft. There are like 25 drafts that come after that. I revise a lot. In fact, I love revision. Revision is my favorite part of writing. Well, I have a writer friend who says she would rather clean toilets in a bus station than write a first draft. I don't feel quite that way. I think if I did, I probably would find another profession. But I agree that it's not the fun part. It's like, I think of it as more like just hoeing. I live on a farm. We have, we garden. So my analogy would be, it's like hoeing a row of corn. You just work and work and work until you get to the end of it. After that, the fun begins. Then it's like weaving, because you know the ending, you know the beginning. You pull them like this so that they cross over. You can pull these little threads of light all the way backwards so that they're little glimmers of what's coming, and vice versa. You can even take pieces of language from different parts of the book and sort of point them at each other. That's so much fun. So when people say they don't like to revise, I'm polite. I don't say anything, but what I think is, you're not a writer. Because that's really where creation occurs. And I would, in fact, if I had my way, still be revising my first novel. I loved writing Ada, not because I think of her as being like me particularly. I don't identify with her per se. She's a little scary. She doesn't like anybody, I mean, she's not very social because of her damage. I mean, she's missing a lot. She's literally missing half her brain, and so she's had to compensate, and she's a messed up person in a lot of ways. But she's also, she's extraordinary, and she has this brilliance, and I got really fascinated. I read several books about hemiplegia, medical texts about what that, because I wanted her to be, again, realistic, actual. And so I read about what the brain does to compensate and all of those things that she does are, sort of that fascination with geometry, with the shapes of things. That's all because of being sort of the one side of the brain compensating for the other. It's a lot to ask of you to follow four narrations. I'm going to make sure that you can, once you're well into the, a third of the way into this book, you could just open it anywhere, read a sentence, and you'd know, oh, that's Ada. That's Rachel. I wanted it to be that accessible. So I wanted these voices to be distinct, which meant I wanted these girls to have very recognizable sort of vocal patterns as well as personalities. So the way I spent actually a year just honing the voices. I would imagine a scene, and then I'd write the same scene in the four voices. Initially, they all kind of sounded like, it was sort of like the 5-year-old puppet, and the 15-year-old puppet, but they were all kind of saying the same thing. So I had to work and work at work and work at sort of making them distinct. And I thought of these different ways. You know, Rachel has these malapropisms, you know, that like the tapestry of justice and Moses coming down from Mount Sinai. And, you know, and why did I need comic relief? Because otherwise you would throw the book across the room. I mean, that's just... And also, I'm a Southern writers. You know, we feel like we have to entertain you a little bit, it's especially in the darkest hours. So, but back to the voices. I thought that Ada, with her specific damage, would see things sort of backwards and forwards at once. And so, I sort of had the idea of palindromes. Let me tell you, palindromes are not. Well, they're maybe easy to think of from time to time, but to put them into a context, I mean, to make it a hymn that you're singing to the tune of Amazing Grace, you know, or to make it, you know, an incantation that someone is singing, to make it work, boy, that's hard. I engaged my whole family. My family's very helpful. They always, you know, they're always very sort of up on what I'm writing. And so I gave my kids, you know, and husband this charge of saying, of helping me think of palindromes. And actually...
So they invented some of these,
Well,
family.
we would start with building blocks,
yes.
You know, with sort of small things, and then sort of... build them, and so. But it's funny. It got to the point where, you know, I like pull up to a stop sign, and the kids would yell "pots." You know, it was just like seeing them, and oh, and I tell you what. So if I thought they were hard to write, wait till my translators got this. When I met my French translator of this novel, we, you know, I went to Paris and, you know, met the editor, met all the people, and they said, oh, you're having lunch with the translator. She has some things to ask you. So I sat down, and she said, you have ruined my life. So I do look back fondly on Ada as difficult. She was prickly, she was challenging, but I loved her so. I loved the person, the point of view she represented.
How do you look at something in so many different ways, and how do you find so many different points of view if they're not yours? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I told you early on, this is a disease state, right? Multiple personalities. It comes with practice. I mean, whether you do a lot of points of view in one novel or whether you do, you know, five novels with different points of view, writing fiction is a long exercise in inhabiting other characters. You just try to be good at it.
When you were talking about hearing voices, but you actually mentioned the word visually imagining your characters as they're watching them in a film.
Yeah.
I'm maybe completely wrong, but have no films yet been made of your books, and are they likely to be? I mean, are they optioned immediately, or are they too difficult?
All of the above, yes. none of them has appeared yet, in a theater near you. They have all, I think, been optioned. Some of them optioned many times, but I have no particular eagerness for a film to see my books translated to film per se. Fundamentally, I would rather there be no film than a bad film. And so that's what has happened. I'm really careful. I'm really particular. It's funny. We novelists get to kind of be control freaks because we work alone, right? I get to do this all by myself. I control everything about my novel, except the jacket, you know, but that's okay. So... entering into collaboration is kind of scary because you realize you cannot control the outcome. You don't know what's going to happen. So I have learned over years of experience of entering into, you know, into collaborations, seeing them go south, reaching a point where I say, oh, your option was 18 months, and 18 months are up, so we're not going to renew. You know, I always sort of build in the capacity to end the deal if things are looking ugly. And that's not always been the case. There have been a couple of times. I worked with HBO to do an 8-part miniseries, one of those. I don't know, do you get HBO here? Yes. Yeah. Okay, so you know the limited series, which is often very beautiful work. It took me a while to understand that TV is the new film. You know, what the sort of edgy stuff that used to be done in movies is now often done in miniseries, and particularly literary fiction, because they don't have to just smack it all into, you know, like a bang bang 90 minutes or whatever. So I actually worked with a wonderful team at HBO to do a six-part miniseries. I wrote the Bible, as they call it. It's a treatment, so it was the Poisonwood Bible, haha. And I wrote 3 episodes. Everyone was really thrilled. We were going ahead, and my team, I got an email one day that said, the producer and director, everybody's been fired. Why were they fired? Because their previous series, which was called Rome, went over budget by like 14 times.
My daughter and I come from completely different worlds. She's a graduate student doing physics, and I'm from the arts. And your book was, she's in California, and we Skyped and had our little book club. She's texting me from California.
I love this.
She's so jealous that I'm sitting
so
with
global.
You. She's
what's, so what's her name?
So her name happening. Is Julia, and she's Julia. A PhD student in California, and she... She's asking me to ask you.
Okay.
Because
Hi,
you mentioned that you're a trained scientist, so that's fascinating. She wants to know what your training is.
My undergraduate, my university degree was in biology, and I went to graduate school in ecology and evolutionary biology.
I actually was living in Georgia when I was introduced to this book, so a lot of people around me had discussions with which of the girls that we identified with, and the vast majority, we all said it was Leah, but I had one particular friend, and she unashamedly said that she was most like Rachel, and I was just wondered, have you come across many people who, out of all of the girls, identify with Rachel the most?
Surprisingly, I do. I mean, it happens. It's not... But I think that when people sort of like in that bubbly way work at it to say, and my favorite was Rachel. I mean, I think they're saying, I loved Rachel. They're not saying, and I loved Rachel. You know, they're not laughing. They're saying, that's me. And I guess I'll take that as a compliment that I loved her enough. You know?
I think it was, well, she kind of said it was fantastic advice, you know, when she stuck out her elbows and said, you know, and her explanation was, she knows how to survive.
Yeah, she was a survivor. Mm. And, you know, this was an exercise for me because I really wanted to give all of these paths their due. And my goal was for you, the reader, not to feel that any one of them was right, but that they were all... possibilities. And the fact is, we need all the kinds of people there are that we have, except maybe, you know, like, okay, there are a few we could do without, but the types of people, the shy ones, the bossy ones, the reticent ones, the obedient ones, the Rachels, the Leahs, the Adas, we really do function best as a society if we don't aspire all to be the same. But do you see what I'm saying? That honoring the sort of person we are is a worthy part of maturity, and maybe it's one of the reasons we read literature. One of the many things that we love about literature is that it engages us to think about the kinds of people there are and the kinds of people we are.
Okay, I just wanted to ask if there was one voice you felt you struggled with more than any of the others.
Yeah, well, Ada was the most difficult for the reasons previously described. Ruth May...
She's kind of hard one to do, isn't she?
She's kind of hard. Yeah, partly because she never gets to be more than 5 years old. So, she had a weight to carry in this novel as well. A lot of wisdom came through her, and yet she was naive, completely naive. You know, she carried nothing into this story, almost nothing. So it's very hard to convey wisdom through, you know, the voice of a book, convincingly through.
And
the
it must
voice
be the hard. Surely it's that must be the hardest, because the other ones, you could do something that approximated to the way those characters might have spoken or written.
Uh-huh.
But your voice for Ruth May is kind of more metaphorical, isn't it? Because
yeah.
she can't actually speak. Well, she can't write like that, and she can't write at all.
Right.
And she can't speak
exactly,
like that, really.
Exactly. It's more of a stretch and more craft involved. And so they all had their challenges. Rachel was the most fun. For me too.
And just to say, I'm sure on your behalf, as well as on mine, to thank Barbara very much. But...
guardian.co.uk/audio